Today's Taisho will be on case 41 in the Blue Rock Collection, the Heikigan Roku. Case 41 is entitled Joshu and the Great Death. Engo's Introduction. When right and wrong are intermingled, even the holy ones cannot distinguish between them. When positive and negative are interwoven, even the Buddha fails to discern one from the other. The most distinguished man of transcendent experience cannot avoid showing his ability as a great master. He walks the ridge of an iceberg. He treads the edge of a sword. He is like the kirin's horn, like the lotus flower in the fire. Meeting a person of transcendent experience, he identifies him as his equal. Who is he? See the following. Main subject. Joshu said to Tosu, "What if a person of the great death comes back to life again?" Tosu said, "You should not go by night. Wait for the light of day and come." Secho's verse. Open-eyed, he was all the more as if dead. What use to test the master with something taboo? Even the Buddha said he had not reached there. Who knows when to throw ashes in another's eyes? Thank you very much for coming to practice this morning, on this winter day. You woke up early and you came here to practice Zen. If this is your first time here, you may have heard the reading of the Taisho with puzzlement. It seems to make so little sense. In fact, it's possible that not even a word of it made any sense. If you're interested in reading the Taisho, reading the koans that are the subject for the Dharma talks, for the Taishos, I recommend this translation by Katsuki Cicada. It's called Two Zen Classics. And if you're a serious Zen student, you should probably own this book. You can go home after the talk, and you can read the koan for yourself. But even if you read it for yourself, it probably won't make much sense. The language of the koans is very poetic and very elusive. It's elusive, very difficult to understand. If you read it, it really will remind you of poetry, and it's really working like poetry. The koan is supposed to resonate on a deeper level than the ordinary, everyday level of communication. So the point of koans is not to interpret them. When I was growing up in school, we used to read Aesop's fables, Greek fables. And we would learn how to interpret the fables and get some kind of a message out of them. So one of the stories we used to read was about the fox and the grapes. And it was how a fox became trapped by his greed for grapes. And when little children listen to the story of the fox who gets caught in a trap because of his hunger for grapes, we are told the message, do not be hungry, or do not be greedy. Be happy with what you have. So the fable is a story which has like a symbolic dimension, and you're supposed to interpret it. And people often read, say, the Bible this way. If you read the Bible, the language of the Bible is often understood to have a symbolic dimension. Jesus spoke in parables. So when he wanted to make a point, he would tell a story maybe about animals or about a farmer sowing wheat. He says the farmer sowed wheat and some of the wheat seeds landed on rock and some of the wheat landed in good soil. And he said, my followers are like the seeds that landed in the good soil. They were receptive and the seeds took root. So that's a parable or a fable. But koans are not supposed to work that way. You really don't have to try too hard to understand a koan. You have to trust the part of your mind that doesn't necessarily think in language. There's a part of your mind which processes on a deeper level. And if you do Zen practice for a while, you begin to activate more fully that part of the mind which isn't conscious. It's like you learn how to activate your unconscious deeper mind and to be receptive and intelligent in a deeper way. There's a kind of intelligence which is uses the discriminating mind. So I don't know if you were following in the news the other day, but they gave to children in East Asia some standardized tests that are used widely in the West to measure students' abilities, especially in math. And the Chinese students scored so high on the tests that the whole world community was astonished. And especially in Shanghai, the students got very, very high scores on this standardized test. And in the meantime, the United States is students in the United States scored very poorly on the test. So now all over the United States, educators are waking up in the middle of the night, terrified that Shanghai students are so much better than American students. This kind of intellectual arms war will probably go on forever. I suppose there's not much we can do about that. Maybe it's possible that American students will study math harder. It seems unlikely, but it could happen. They may overcome their terror of math and do a little better on the test. That would be good, but there's another kind of intelligence. There's another kind of intelligence which doesn't work that way. It also requires cultivation. But it processes information on a deeper level, on an unconscious level. So, you may be struggling with a certain kind of personal problem. Maybe there's a person in your family who has become ill. And you have to care for that person, and it's very demanding of your time, and very difficult. I myself have spent the last 2.5 years taking care of my father-in-law, who was quite ill. He died just recently, and he was sick for a long time. And he was 90 when he died, so he had a very nice life. But caring for somebody who is sick and in pain and who is going to die is quite an education. It's not the sort of education you get in school, but it's a very profound kind of education because you come face to face with what the Buddha encountered. At the beginning of his search for enlightenment, sickness, old age, and death. And I suppose we all imagine, in a certain way, that we will never die. There's a certain part of ourselves that just doesn't allow allow ourselves to deal with that. But when you're caring for somebody you knew 20 or 30 years ago to be energetic and lively, creative, and so on. My father-in-law was a really nice man. He was a design engineer, and he was very lively person, very creative. He made his own furniture. He designed his own house. He was a bit of a ladies' man. As a matter of fact, he was not an honest husband. He cheated a bit on his wife, I'm sorry to say. He was kind of a rascal. There were reasons to be mad at him sometimes, but he had this charming personality, and I liked him. You know, actually, when I was young, I thought he was a cool guy. Now, many years later, my wife and I have been caring for this man as he reached the end of his rope. And it's very moving. It could also be quite disturbing. You know, intellectually, we all know we're going to die, but in another way, we don't allow ourselves to imagine that we personally are going to die. And caring for somebody who's really deteriorating, really suffering and sick, forces you, you know, to come face to face with this reality. You realize, I too will be here. Now, you know, we all know this intellectually, but when you encounter it in a certain way, it can have a great deal of force and resonance. You know, it could even become troubling to you. You could wake up in the middle of the night and think, why can't I sleep? And you might know it's because I realize now that my life too has a limit. Now, this is a different kind of, this is a different part of ourselves, different part of our mind. And it requires a different kind of intelligence, if that makes any sense. You know, encountering sickness, old age, and death, though that kind of an experience can't be solved with the discriminating mind. Can't be solved with the discriminating mind. We all know. The average life expectancy in the United States is 78 years. We all know everybody's... There isn't intellectually a problem here. There isn't intellectually a problem here, but there is a problem for a deeper part of ourselves. And there's nothing anybody can say, I think, that will really solve this problem intellectually. People could say, well, you know, he was 90, he had a nice life, or you're likely to live long life too, or whatever. But there's a part of ourselves that could be troubled by encountering a person we love who was lively and bright and intelligent and creative, now too sick to sit up in bed and so on. And we might wake up at night and think, why am I troubled by this? See, I'm troubled in my heart because I see that my own life is coming to an end. See? Or I'm sure this makes some sense. And you can't solve the problem with your intellect. There's nothing anybody can say to you that's going to make it better, right? It requires a different kind of change in yourself, change at a deeper level. And you might be troubled for a long time. And then, you know, something might happen to you, some experience that might even seem to have nothing to do with taking care of this old man who's dying. And all of a sudden, you could turn around or open up, and you could feel very good, very alive, and very open to everything around you. And you might say, why do I feel better now? How did this happen? See, there's a kind of deeper transformation that can take place. Sometimes we suffer a lot. And we're suffering, 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 suffering. And then, you know, something inside ourselves opens up. And our suffering disappears and we feel more deeply connected to life. Sometimes this can happen by accident. Sometimes it happens by accident in a natural way. But sometimes we get stuck. You know, something happens to us and we can't get free of it. It's like being at a door we can't make open up. And you can use the intellect to try to open the door, but it's no good. It doesn't work. The transformation has to happen on a deeper level. See, one way to understand Zen practice is that it's the art of it's the art of transformation at that deeper level. That what we're really doing on the cushion is working through the obstacles that we encounter in our lives. And this working through begins on a level that's deeper than the discriminating mind. See? So these koans are really not about giving you ideas to hold on to, right? Giving you fables to apply to your life, or parables. This is about learning how to undergo a transformation at a deeper level. And there's a real art to this. This is what meditation is all about. So the koans don't speak in the language of the discriminating intellect. They speak in a language which is like poetry. Or, I don't know if you've ever had this happen, but sometimes when people wake up out of sleep after a deep dream, they can remember their dream enough to realize that it doesn't really make ordinary sense. You know, when we remember our dreams, we try to make them fit into a story form. But sometimes, if you're very close to your dreams, you realize that they don't really fit the story form. Things happen strangely, and sometimes they can be very moving. You know, it's like there's a language of dreams, which is a little different from the ordinary language of, say, a cookbook. Right? The cookbook is like the language of ordinary intellect, right? Add 3 eggs, whip the eggs, you know, add some sugar, add some butter, you know. That's like discriminating mind. But there's another language, which is this language which is right on the edge of the unconscious, and that's the language of the koan. So when we're meditating, we are learning how to use a deeper intelligence that we have in order to open doors in ourselves when we become blocked by life. Okay? So, Lord Buddha was a wealthy young man. According to legend, he was a noble person. His father was supposed to be a king. And he had a bright future ahead. And then he encountered sickness, old age, and death. And it was like a door closing in his face. And he lost all trust in life. You know, you could say, all trust in life. And there was nothing people could say to him that would make him feel better. People could say, well, of course, you know, there's sickness. Of course, you know, people get sick. People get old. People die. Why did it bother him so much? See? But it's on a deeper level, this was troubling. Now, intellectually, not a problem. But on a deeper level, a terrible problem for him. And so, basically, he left his father's home and his wife and his child, and he became joined the forest-dwelling rishis and practiced meditation day and night. So, this is like our path, too. We meditate, and we're learning how to do what the Buddha did. So this koan, as I said, probably makes no sense. Joshu asked Tosu, "What if a man of the great death comes back to life again?" Tosu said, "You should not go by night. Wait for the light of day to come." I don't want to spoil the koan by explaining it in intellectual terms, but maybe I can say a few things about it that will help it help you to use it as a tool for opening up when you encounter an obstacle. You know, if you do meditation, you will find it can be tremendously helpful, tremendously healing and liberating. Sometimes we experience things in life that cause us enormous distress and suffering. In fact, many people come to meditation because they have experienced events in their lives that produce stress and suffering. And often they don't even know what the origin of their suffering might be. This is quite typical. So people just feel unhappy, or people feel tense all the time, nervous or fearful all the time, or people feel or people are suffering in ways they can't even clearly state. This is like ordinary life for many people. Sometimes people come to meditation for very different reasons. But I must say, I had a lot of problems when I was young with like a chronic anxiety, right? Chronic anxiety. And it was difficult for me to do things that were rather simple for other people, I thought, because of my anxiety. And I suppose I was also somewhat depressed. And when I went to the Seattle Zen Center and began to practice meditation, it helped me enormously to feel better. And I didn't know why I was suffering, and I didn't know why meditation made me feel better, but it definitely made me feel much better. One way to think about meditation is that it's operating on an unconscious level to help open these doors that painful experiences have closed inside of us. And it doesn't necessarily require that we understand understand what's happening. If we simply do it, we will feel better. It's not necessary to consciously understand what's happening. Not always. When I came into the Seattle Zen Center, people showed me how to sit properly on the cushion, how to straighten my back and breathe with the dantian, and watch the breath. And I started doing this, and I think I instantly felt better. I don't know why I kept sitting, because physically it was really challenging for me. It was very hard to sit in the proper way on the cushion. It was I would at the end of 20 minutes I would literally be perspiring. It was so hard to maintain the posture. And yet, even though this was physically challenging for me, I felt better. When I would come home from meditation, at first subtly, and then in more obvious ways, I would be more relaxed, more open, happier, less fearful. And I probably never thought consciously, I'm more relaxed, I'm less fearful, but I was. And even though meditation was physically demanding for me, was very challenging physically, I kept going back, and it was like a bee circling a little flower. This was so nourishing for me. I felt unconsciously better when I did it. And so I kept doing it. And it was it got better and better. You know, I sat on the cushion with my back straight, and even though it was very hard, I watched my breath, and one day I had the most extraordinary experience. I was watching my breath and watching my breath and watching my breath and thinking, you know, this is so stupid. You know, why doesn't the teacher give me something to do besides watch my breath? And then all of a sudden, it was as though everything in the universe disappeared. It was just like blank, blank. And when that happened, I didn't go, oh my gosh, what an amazing experience. I thought, huh, you know. And then I went back to watching the breath. Later, I noticed it again. There was this blankness. And the first time it happened to me, it was like suddenly falling down a well, and there's absolutely nothing at the bottom of the well. It was just like I was watching my breath, and all of a sudden, nothing. There was nothing. And I began to go back to this place. And our word for this is in Zen. Our word for this place is mu. In Sanskrit, the word for this is shunyata. Shunyata, emptiness. It was odd, but when I would meditate and watch my breath, and when I would enter shunyata, for a long time, it was just nothing. It was just absolutely blank. And I had no response at all. But eventually, I began to feel very, very good. Very, very alive when I got off the cushion. And I realize now that this shunyata, this emptiness, which sounds like such a bad thing, right, was really deeply healing, deeply liberating. You know. I could sit down on the cushion, and I could be very stressed, you know, my own personality, my own upbringing, made me a very stressful person. You know, very, very like a. I had a very little trust in life, and so I was always expecting things to blow up in my face. And so I was really like nervous all the time, stressed. Now, you know, people have normal levels of stress, but I think my stress was abnormally high. When I would meditate, I would get off the cushion, and my stress level would be much lower, much lower. And when I would meditate and encounter emptiness, I would get off the cushion, and I was like, felt strangely connected to things around me. You know, if you're always nervous and you're always fearful, you tend to feel disconnected. And it becomes a mental habit of being a little bit withdrawn or a little bit disconnected. It's like a safety mechanism. And this is sort of like my default position in life, you know, sort of a little fearful all the time. Hanging back, yeah? When I would enter samadhi, when I would enter deep concentration, get off the cushion, I would be more relaxed, less stressful. One thing that I was surprised to see this was that when I went into deep mushin, into deep shunyata, when I would get off the cushion, I felt very connected to things around me. Some of you may have encountered that yourselves. You know, last night, or a few nights ago, one of the people in our group, who's rather new, came up to me after the meditation and he said, "What is the tea?" He says, "This tea is so delicious. It's more delicious than any tea I've ever had in my life." And I said, "It's actually very good tea. I think Yvette brought it from Taiwan. Taiwan tea is really good tea, but that's not why it's so delicious. It's so delicious because you've just come out of shunyata, out of deep emptiness. And when you come out of shunyata and you are in the world of form once again, it can be like heaven. So wonderful. So wonderful." And he said that to me maybe a week ago, actually. He told me about the tea and I responded. And then last night again, I said, "How are you?" And he said, "Oh, the tea. It's so great." It's possible to think about Buddhism in the wrong way. So, if you are interested in comparative religion and you read about religions, you might read about a particular religion that says we're all going to go to heaven, and it's great. And you might read about a religion that says our religion is all about bliss, all about bliss. And when you read about Buddhism, the first thing it says is sickness, old age, and death. Right? So you can say, "Oh, wow, that's really heavy. That's really very difficult to deal with." And then if you read about more about Buddhism, you might talk about nothingness, emptiness. You might think, "Oh my God, first we start with sickness, old age, and death, and then we go to nothingness." No, that's very unappealing. That sounds very morbid, very unhappy. But please don't misunderstand that, on the contrary, it's easy to think that Buddhism is about being empty, being totally detached, being absolutely selfless, right? And indeed, there is an element in Buddhist practice of being empty, of having no self, etc. If you're watching your breath, if you're practicing pranayama, if you're watching your breath, and breath meditation was the kind of meditation the Lord Buddha taught, if you're sitting on the cushion and you're watching your breath, at some point, self-consciousness is going to disappear. And you're going to be unified with the breath. And you're not going to be thinking, "I'm breathing." The boundary between yourself and the world, or the distance between the self and the world, is going to disappear, and you're going to feel totally connected to the breath. See, so what sounds terrible, selflessness, no self, is actually experientially very wonderful, beautiful experience. Right? If you go into nothingness, shunyata, you think, "Oh my God, nothingness. That sounds so terrible." Now, Buddhism starts with sickness, old age, and death, and then it goes to nothingness. But actually, if you're in nothingness, it's very, very energizing. Very mushin, we say mushin, emptiness mind, is very energizing. When I was a kid, I loved comic books. And my favorite comic book hero was the Green Lantern. And they're going to make a movie out of from the Green Lantern. It's coming out soon. I'm sure it will be terrible. But, nevertheless, the comics were wonderful. And the hero had a lantern that was like a superpower battery from another universe, basically. And he had a ring that he wore on his finger, and he would take the ring and press it onto the lantern and charge up his ring with super energy. And the energy would allow him to fly all over the universe and so on. Well, actually, when you go into shunyata, it's like Green Lantern charging up his ring. You sit down on the cushion and you enter emptiness, and instead of feeling blank deadness, if you keep practicing, you're going to feel like pulsing energy, really wonderful. You know, sometimes I sit down on the cushion and this energy is very, very strong. It's like a little bomb going off. So this pulsing energy, is always there. It's always there. But we're usually too fearful and nervous to feel it, see? And so when we begin to practice emptiness meditation, we're stripping away all these layers of karma, all these obstacles, these psychological obstacles. And it may not happen all the time, but you know, with some regularity, you will begin to feel very good when you're in shunyata, when you're in mushin. Zen practice is really all about moving from the world of form into emptiness, and from emptiness back into the world of form. See, so we are actually when we're born, we really have we're really kind of formless. You know, we really don't have much of a personality. We learn how to be a self, and actually becoming a self is all about creating obstacles. Really, you know, a particular identity is like a collection of closed doors. That's how you become a self. This door gets closed, this door gets closed, this door gets closed, and pretty soon you're Kurt, or you're Bob, or you're Susan. See? The self is really like made up of obstacles, or the self is really like a collection of moments where we have been separated from the world and we haven't been able to overcome that split. And that's what makes a self. And so naturally the self is the occasion for like a lot of distress or suffering. But when we go into the world of formlessness, into shunyata, we can often open the doors inside ourselves once again. It takes a lot of work, but we can begin to open these doors inside ourselves. And strangely, when the doors open up, we feel better, and more alive, and so on and so on. So if you think about Zen practice, it's really, you know, or human life. If you think about human life is all about closing doors and opening doors. And the universe has a wonderful opportunity every once in a while to become a person, right? The universe is really like formless and empty, but it can become a person, and the person is like a closed door. That's the adventure of personhood, is like the universe is this open flow, and it gets blocked, and that's a person, right? And it sounds like a big problem, but actually being blocked is what it takes to be a human, you know? And then, when you're blocked, you feel distress, but you can find ways to work through your distress and open up again and be back in the flow. And this is like the human adventure, right? It's like being separated and then reunited. Separated and reunited, separated and reunited. That's the human adventure, you know. In the process of going from separation to reunited, you know, we do all kinds of interesting things. We paint beautiful pictures, we write poetry, we fall in love, we raise a family, we discover a new life form, we discover how to do fun things with isotopes, whatever. It's the adventure of being a human, right? And one of the things that makes the adventure of being a human so sweet is that we don't have to be blocked forever. we can open the door. And when we open the door and we get back into the universe, it's really wonderful. So, you know, in Zen we talk about the two aspects. We talk about Buddha nature and we talk about true nature. We have these two terms that get thrown around and people don't always pay attention to them. Buddha nature and true nature. And they're not exactly the same. See, a Buddha nature is like the fundamental energy. Yeah. And that's empty. That's formless. That's always present, always the same, right? Formless energy, emptiness. That's a Buddha nature. Okay. There's also what we call true nature. And everybody, each of us has to find our own true nature. You know, Buddha nature is undifferentiated, universal, always present, always the same. But a true nature is individual. Each of us has to find our true nature. And the interesting thing is that when we are true to our true nature, when we're living in harmony in the proper way, it's easy to be one with Buddha nature. I don't know if this is making any sense, but, you know, maybe your father says that you should be a lawyer and join his law firm, okay? And you think, oh, I might not really want to be a lawyer, but I really want to please my dad or my mother. So you go to law school and you start practicing law and you realize this is not what I really wanted. It doesn't have to be law. It could be professor. Your parents say, oh, if only you could become a professor. So you become a professor and then one day you realize, I really don't want to be a professor. You know, it pleases my mother and father for me to be a professor, but I'm unhappy on some level. I'm in distress. And you sit on the cushion and you go into deep mushin and sooner or later you admit to yourself, you know, I don't really want to be a professor. And then it might occur to you after doing enough meditation that what you really want to do is paint pictures. You know? And that's terrifying, right? Because all your life you've been told you should be a professor, but what you really want to do is paint pictures. Now, Buddhism says you should go into deep mushin until you know what you want to do, until you know what will make you feel most alive and free and fearless and compassionate. And interestingly, if you are true to your true nature, if you live the life that makes you feel most free, connected, awake, and compassionate, that's when you feel most connected to the universe, you know? So it's like when you are most your true self, when you're most fully your true self, that's when you're most fully connected to the universe. I think that's fascinating. I'm probably not making any sense today. But, some people, I have a friend of mine, he's a philosopher, and I can understand only like 1 out of every 10 words that he writes. But he loves it. He's totally happy writing this stuff, which I myself can barely understand. And when he does that kind of thing, he feels connected to the starry dynamo of the universe. You know, it's just he's in the groove. He's where he should be. See, and this is perfect, right? He's being true to his true nature, and when he's true to his particular true nature, which is just his and nobody else's, he feels most connected to the universe. So, true nature and Buddha nature are kind of, they're different, but they go hand in hand, hand in hand. you have to encounter, I think, it helps to encounter shunyata. It helps to encounter shunyata when you aren't sure about how to be true to your true self, your true nature. Because the experience of emptiness can liberate you from all these fears and all of these inhibitions and all of these fantasies and so on and so on. And then, you know, I think life can be quite wonderful when you can connect the big and the small, the personal and the universal, when you can connect the formless and the world of form, and so on and so on. This is like the ultimate goal of Zen practice, is this kind of unity. We speak of a unified mind in accord with the way. All self-centered striving ceases, and doubts, so on. This is the goal. Normally, you know, we are doubtful and irresolute, right? We're worried, we second-guess ourselves, we don't trust ourselves. And this can be the condition in which we live our lives forever and ever. You know, you get up every day and think, am I where I want to be? I don't think I'm where I want to be. Should I feel that way? Do I have a right to feel that way? Maybe I don't. You know what? This is a human condition of self-doubt and doubting the world, right? But if you practice Zen, if you spend a lot of time in emptiness, you know, you gradually can open these doors, and self-doubt gradually goes away. You gradually feel greater confidence. You trust that part of yourself that normally we don't trust, right? You know, when we do our meditation retreats, we go away and we meditate for 9 or 10 hours a day for 5 or 7 days. And people work on koans, like the one I'm discussing today, and they encounter obstacles in themselves. And it might take 5 days, it might take a year of sesshins. Sooner or later, they work through the koan, and that requires them to trust themselves, to trust themselves. And sometimes it's so hard for us to trust ourselves. Right? And so, you know, difficult. But the beauty of Zen practice is that if you stay in that emptiness long enough, your true self will speak, and you'll be able to hear it and act from that place. And that's like heaven, right? That's the perfect life. Joshu said to Tosu, what if a man of the great death comes back to life again? See, this is when you are in deep mushin, everything disappears. Everything. Everything, when you're in emptiness, everything is gone. And basically, Joshu is asking Tosu, what happens then, see? What happens after you've been into deep mushin? It's a simple question. And Tosu answers, what Tosu could have said was, Joshu says, what if a man of the great death comes back to life again? But Tosu could have said, when that happens, the tea is so delicious, see? Or he could have said, when that happens, I feel like dancing. Right? It hasn't happened yet, but I'm waiting. One of these days, after Zazen, somebody is going to get up and just dance across the room. Right? Really. It could happen, right? If you don't feel like doing it, don't do it. But if you feel like doing it, see, you should do it. You know? See, imagine having that much trust in yourself, right? When I was a little boy, I used to watch, when I was living in, we were living in Baltimore, and there was nothing to do all day long, and I would watch TV, and I used to watch these movies from the 1940s in which people, they were musicals. As a little kid, I loved musicals. People would be walking down the street, and suddenly they'd start singing, and they'd dance, right? And I remember my mother took me to the barber shop, And the barbers were cutting hair, and it was my turn to go up. And all of a sudden, they turned on the radio. And I had seen these movies where people just hear music and they start dancing. And I swear to you, I actually started to dance. Everybody was astounded, and my mother went, "What's wrong with you?" Really? She went, "What, you lost your mind?" What a pity. See, what a pity. That was so true. That was such a true thing to do, right? I heard the music and I had to dance, right? It's perfect. That's natural. So my mother closed the door, right? She closed the door and made me more of a self, right? But you know, you sit in that emptiness, and after a while you think, should I do it? Should I do it? See, that's what koan training is all about. You think, should I do it? Should I do it? No, no. Mother yelled at me. I'm not going to do it, right? But then, you know, sooner or later, after 5 days of sitting, you go in and you go, all right, here's the answer to my koan. That's trust. Trust in life. Right? Most of us just don't have it. We don't have it. But, you know, that's why we're practicing Zen. Every once in a while, we go, okay, I'm going to trust life. And when we do, it's wonderful, right? It's wonderful. Then, the large and the small, the empty and the world of form and the world of the formless, all this matches up like two halves, like a yin and yang, right? So it matches up. And everything is, that's life, right? Fulfilled life. Joshua said to Tosu, what if a man of the great death comes back to life again? Tosu could have jumped up and danced. I'll show you. That would have been a good answer. He could have said, the tea is delicious. He could have squeezed Joshua's nose. You know, being true to his true nature, see? That's the thing. It's hard, right? Even if you were sitting on the cushion all this time feeling like dancing, would you, you know, when I ring the bell, would you get up and go, all right, here you are? You know, we don't have that trust. But, you know, if you keep practicing, sooner or later, you begin to have it. It just a little bit, and life becomes much, much better. Secho's verse, open-eyed, he was all the more as if dead. What use to test the master with something taboo? Even the Buddha said he had not reached there. Who knows when to throw ashes in another's eyes?